Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This summer, a 20-year-old man pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in the death of a 15-year-old girl from Roseville. While murder convictions aren't rare, this specific case caught the attention of other prosecutors around California because it is believed to be the first in the state in which a fentanyl dealer was convicted of murder. In recent years, fentanyl deaths have skyrocketed. The drug is 50 times stronger than heroin and 100 times stronger than morphine. Increasingly, it is unknowingly laced into counterfeit prescription pills like Xanax or Percocet, for example, which is why public health officials warn one pill can kill. But prosecuting these cases have been difficult, given the harmful impacts of the war on drugs in the 80s and 90s, which greatly impacted neighborhoods of color seen to this day, and an evolving approach to distinguish the public health crisis of mental health and addiction. That debate has been emotional and fraught at the state capitol as lawmakers navigate the best way to curb this epidemic. I sat down with Placer County's district attorney, Morgan Geyer, to discuss what motivated him to seek and secure the first murder conviction of a fentanyl death in the state. He also urged the need to strike a balance between public health and safety to turn the tide in the fentanyl crisis. District Attorney Geyer, thank you for making the time.
Thank you very much for having me. My pleasure.
You made the fentanyl crisis a top priority when you took office back in 2020. Why was this issue specifically so important to you?
Lots of factors. We were thrust into the crisis in 2020. We were in the middle of a global pandemic. The world was shut down. And our county, not unique to other communities, was seeing an alarming rate of particularly teenagers and young adults dying from fentanyl. They were probably engaging in risk-taking behavior more than they were probably prone to, given the circumstances of the pandemic. We had seniors in high school missing life-defining moments, people who were already prone to depression because of isolation and things like that were exacerbated. And we, as a team, just sort of realized we had to do more.
We've had this conversation on Insight multiple times over the last couple of years, and unfortunately, it's just continued to grow and evolve in the wrong direction in California. I remember in 2021 talking to parents who lost a child from fentanyl poisoning, and they do emphasize poisoning because these counterfeit pills are unknowingly laced with fentanyl. Can you explain for listeners that distinction between overdosing and poisoning?
Absolutely. And that was a steep learning curve for me during this fentanyl crisis. And it began with what became sort of a high profile case in our community. It was a high school senior named Zach Didier who had died from fentanyl poisoning. And it was in my discussions with his family as we were reviewing the case. We sadly had other cases we were reviewing to figure out this ultimate question of how and should you hold someone responsible for selling something that is dangerous to someone else. And in this discussion, these parents who had never really heard of what fentanyl was before until the coroner told them that was the cause of their son's death had said he was poisoned. And we sort of had this very marked discussion about it. And it was very enlightening to me. And it was illustrating that there are two separate fronts of this fentanyl crisis that we are fighting. There are those who are battling addiction, those who are seeking fentanyl. And unfortunately, with the lethality of the fentanyl that's in today's market, we are losing those people more rapidly. Usually drug addiction, if it goes untreated, will cost you your life, but after a long, prolonged battle. This aspect of fentanyl, the poisoning aspect of it, was completely different. These were people who were being deceived, and they took something that they thought was something else. And the sort of example that I have used, because I heard from some of these parents, were if I walked into a bar and ordered a shot of whiskey, and someone poured me a shot of cyanide and I drank it, no one would say I overdosed on cyanide. They would say you were poisoned. You took something that you thought was something else. You were deceived, and it cost you your life. And it became clear that there's a difference. And there's also, I think, a social difference a little bit in how we describe the problem. And part of that, and it's a difficult line to draw because there is some shame involved in the taking of those substances because it's something somebody shouldn't have done. And so calling it an overdose sort of has societal implications. Not that those are not worthy of treating, not that those aren't worthy of fighting, but it's a different situation. And I think the way we try and proactively fight this fight, we need to be precise with our vocabulary. And that was very, very informative to me to have that conversation.
And in that time, fentanyl deaths have skyrocketed across the state. In Placer County, data from the county shows a 450% increase in fentanyl deaths between 2019 and 2021. One piece of responding to this is criminal justice and holding those responsible accountable. What are the challenges and kind of the nuances with achieving that goal when it comes specifically to fentanyl?
Yeah, and I appreciate the intro there. It is one piece of an overall campaign in this fentanyl crisis. It is critically important. This fentanyl crisis is not, it's not just a public health issue, and it's not just a public safety or criminal justice issue. It's a combination of all of those things. So when it comes to the criminal justice aspect, it hadn't been done before. The idea that we're punishing drug dealers for selling drugs that are ultimately harmful, that's been done forever, and we have debated how best to handle those who are selling drugs. But fentanyl changed the landscape. Its accessibility, its lethality, the deception around it was costing lives right and left. And so this question became, how do we appropriately identify those who need to be held accountable versus those who might be in need of treatment because they themselves are addicts? And it's a very fine line on how we draw that distinction. But what we do is we are guided by the evidence of any particular investigation. Is someone's motive for selling profit? And if it is motivated by profit, are they aware of the risks? And how can we determine and ultimately demonstrate to a jury, if we choose to charge, what the evidence is that separates someone who is motivated by this deadly profit as opposed to someone who is struggling to feed their own addiction? And it's incumbent upon prosecutors to identify those differences. But that's sort of the hallmarks of determining whether or not someone is deserving of criminal prosecution, and then if they are, whether or not that ultimately results in a murder charge or something legally less than that.
The reason why we're talking to you is because your office secured a second-degree murder conviction of a fentanyl dealer. That is the first of its kind in California. Given that fentanyl is a crisis that spans and transcends California across the country, in this state specifically, why is this conviction so rare? Why is Placer County the first?
We have a limited amount of criminal liability statutes that can hold someone accountable for the act of selling something that ends up being deadly. So we have, on the low end of causing someone's death, we have involuntary manslaughter, which is punished not real significantly. And under California law, someone who causes the death of someone else through recklessness or negligence, you have that on the one sort of side of the spectrum. And on the other end, we have murder, which obviously is the most extreme punishment that we can ask for in criminal law as it relates to the death of someone. The real question for prosecutors is, and I teach courses to law enforcement and to students, and I always say when it comes to being a prosecutor, there's the debate of can you do something, and then there's the more complicated debate of should you do something. And that's why I think, given the number of deaths we've had in our county, we've seen a very small percentage of those investigations result in the filing of criminal charges. And that's because either we can't prove it, or in those situations that we can, the question, should we, is answered in the negative.
The case that resulted in this conviction involved the fentanyl death of a 15-year-old girl from Roseville. The man who was convicted is 20-year-old Nathaniel Kabakungun. Can you tell us more about this case and what stood out to you about this case?
So I will speak somewhat generally. The case is still pending sentencing. So following the sentencing, I can speak a little more freely about
that. That's later this month, correct?
It is, yes. It's set for the 16th of this month. But generally, in these kinds of cases, what we look for is sort of what I mentioned earlier, is are there those hallmarks of knowledge about the danger of what the substance is? Is there that sort of profit motivation? Is there what we refer to as sort of a deadly ambivalence, that appreciation of a risk and a disregarding of that risk, saying, I don't care. I know what I'm doing is dangerous and deadly, but I'm going to engage in this behavior anyway. And when we can answer those questions as a yes, it clearly moves the needle towards some sort of criminal prosecution, and in these cases, murder, when the evidence that underlies someone's knowledge of how dangerous their behavior is overwhelming and can obviously be proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
You mentioned Zachary Didier, and that was a 17-year-old Rockland teen who died in 2020 due to fentanyl poisoning. In the courtroom for this second-degree murder conviction was his parents. And in his case specifically, that suspect pled guilty in 2022, sentenced to 17 years for involuntary manslaughter in addition to other charges. How did this case lay the framework for this second-degree murder conviction?
The Bordner case, the case in which Zach Didier was killed, was our first one. It was the first one in our county. It was one of the relatively first ones to be in the COVID era of a fentanyl poisoning. And we had to navigate by looking around throughout the state of how other offices were handling it. We obviously know our theories of liability and we know what our options were. But nothing really had reached the goal line yet on the murder aspect of it. So we were going through the investigation to try and determine how do we hold the person, should we hold this person responsible, and if so, how. Clearly, the selling of deadly fentanyl to someone is at a very minimum negligent, reckless, and is the basis for an involuntary manslaughter charge. But as we were making our way through Zach's case, we kept having more and more teenagers and young adults dying. And unfortunately, they all usually typically start as a coroner case where there's a medical emergency. And it's not seen as a crime scene. It's not seen necessarily as something that might lead to criminal punishment when someone has a medical emergency that requires first responders to come in and either transport them or attempt CPR. So our ability to gauge and analyze these investigations sadly got better through it happening more and more.
Now, since your conviction in July, there are two other Northern California district attorneys who have filed murder charges in fentanyl deaths. One is in Sutter County, and the other, which was just filed this week, it was by Sacramento County District Attorney Tian Ho, who you worked with during your 15 years in the Sacramento County DA's office. Is there collaboration or even communication among district attorneys since you all are grappling with the same crisis?
There are, and fortunately, the especially the Northern California district attorneys communicate frequently. We have sort of regional meetings. This has been the one of the most significant issues affecting our offices for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So most have already done the analysis of whether or not they would be willing, under the right circumstances, to file these kinds of cases, and really just waiting for those facts to present themselves. Not waiting as in, I can't wait and I'm hoping, but with that dread of, at some point, we're going to find an investigation with a set of facts that are going to deserve, in our opinion, the filing of murder charges. So we're all familiar with the law. It's really just a sharing of investigative tactics because these are relatively new investigations. And how do you piece together the final moments of someone's life as they interact with the individual who sold them the deadly fentanyl? So we trade tactics and tips in that respect. But I think the fundamental question of whether or not murder charges should be filed in these circumstances ultimately rests with the discretion of the elected DA of that particular county. And you've seen those that are willing to do so. And you may see more in the future, or you may hear from some that say, I don't think this is ever appropriate.
And your office currently has filed other murder charges against other suspected fentanyl dealers, correct?
We have, yes. We have two others currently pending.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we've been speaking with Placer County District Attorney Morgan Geyer, who secured the first murder conviction against a fentanyl dealer in California. Earlier this year, the California legislature, they debated how to address the fentanyl crisis, and that led to emotional testimony during committee hearings. The central debate among lawmakers, and really I think the general public as well, was whether to combat this crisis through public safety and tougher punishments or focus more on education and prevention. What stands out to you about this debate?
What stands out remarkably is that I think our legislature did a very good job in responding to the public health aspect of the fentanyl crisis. And I was a little, frankly, disappointed in the response and their actions as it relates to public safety. This is not a unilateral situation that requires only a certain kind of approach. We need all tools available. I am very cognizant of the concern and fear about sort of reinvigorating the failed war on drugs. And that is oftentimes what is said in response to prosecutors who are seeking to be aggressive to those who are selling deadly fentanyl. But we need to be able to attack both the education, outreach, and prevention side to reduce demand. But we also need to be able to aggressively hold people accountable who know exactly what they're doing. And that falls on the district attorney to be able to do that. And we need flexibility and a number of different tools so that our only option isn't a murder charge when we wouldn't want one to be there. Mm.
When it comes to the war on drugs, you know, opponents who, you know, don't want harsher penalties for the fentanyl cases, you know, they argue that during the country's crack epidemic, it inevitably created harmful consequences for underserved communities, communities of colors, and these communities that still can be felt very much today. What is your response to those concerns, especially when striking the right balance, as you're talking about, striking that right balance between public safety with prevention and treatment?
It's an excellent question, and I would start off by pointing out that the victims of this fentanyl crisis are overwhelmingly people of color and disadvantaged communities, and they are being ravaged by this illicit and deadly fentanyl. Striking that balance is key, and there were a lot of lessons learned, I think, from what we consider the war on drugs from the 80s and 90s that were had very punitive measures towards people who were battling addiction, people who were perhaps selling to feed that addiction. And I think fentanyl, while the profit motivation for selling drugs hasn't changed, that's the same motivation that has been present as long as we've been living together as a society. This is different. Fentanyl has changed the landscape. The lethality of it is unbelievable. And we are starting to become aware of that intimately. Everyone is starting to aware. You can't become aware. You can't travel around our communities in Sacramento County, Placer County, all of our surrounding counties without seeing warnings, without seeing billboards, without having heard of these stories. And the idea that someone can take a small amount of this and die on their first occasion, and a dealer very well may know that, is what sort of lends to the idea that we need to be holding dealers more accountable. But finding that balance is absolutely critical. Unfortunately, well, I say fortunately, district attorneys are charged with that amount of discretion, and there's no way to craft a law that prevents us from exercising discretion and having any sort of ability to hold someone accountable. Because whether we like it or not, there are those who know exactly what they're doing, and they're poisoning people, and they're making a profit on it, and that's more important than the health and safety of their customers.
Given that you've been dissatisfied with the public safety aspect of legislation that's making its way through the Capitol, which would, you know, I think in your view, make your job easier and other district attorneys' jobs easier when it comes to having penalties against fentanyl dealers, you know, is what you're doing now by securing the first murder conviction in California when it came to a fentanyl death, is this kind of finding a way around legislation as these bills are kind of in limbo and they're moving through the state capitol?
I would never file a murder charge simply because I don't have any other alternative. The facts and circumstances of a case justify a murder charge or they don't. I would like some other flexibility because while those cases are going to be rare and represent a very small number, there are other situations where a murder charge would not be appropriate, but my ability to hold someone accountable may be not enough, frankly. And there, we don't have a lot of flexibility on that aspect. There are dealers of all different varieties and up and down the food chain in this hierarchy of drug dealers. There are high quantity dealers who are selling hundreds or thousands of pills at a time that could be lethal to an entire community. There are those street level dealers who are selling 5 to 10 pills at a time. Those are the ones that we see killing people in our community more often because that's the direct interface that our users have or our victims that are purchasing these. So I would like to see a little bit more flexibility and just a few more tools in our toolbox, so to speak, to be able to hold those dealers accountable. But again, the murder charges are going to be there based on their own merits and not simply because, well, everything else is too lenient. Therefore, I'm going to charge something for murder that otherwise wouldn't independently. We're not going to be doing that, and I trust no other district attorney would feel that way either. But there is room to have more flexibility in our criminal law.
Finally, you're born and raised in Placer County, and now you're the Placer County District Attorney. You have been for the last couple of years. What makes you optimistic that, you know, we're at, or hopefully soon, at a turning point in this crisis?
While the focus of most of my conversations lately have been on the criminal justice aspect of it, my hope comes from our outreach efforts. Placer County, like we discussed, we had tackled that early on. We had reached every high school student by last year. Every high school student had attended an assembly. We had talked to parents. We've had conversations in the community about signs, sort of new signs, not just automatic self-isolation or failing school, the classic hallmark signs of a kid who is struggling. But we've seen kids who are straight-A students who are dying of fentanyl. And that has caused families to have conversations that they otherwise wouldn't have had about how are you feeling and what sort of pressures are you under. And through those conversations, I know that we're saving lives. It's always hard to calculate how many lives you've saved through this, but through the conversations our communities are having throughout our region, I know that it's having an impact. The numbers, at least for 2023 that we've seen, tend to show that the youth, the teenagers and young adults, those numbers are reducing. We will still have those who are dying from fentanyl of all ages, but it seems to be the average age seems to be trending upward, which means those outreach efforts are hopefully finding their target audience, which is the teenagers and young adults. So I'm optimistic that through those efforts, combined with our public safety efforts, we're making a difference in saving lives.
District Attorney Geyer, thank you for the time.
Thank you so much for having this conversation with me. I really appreciate it.
That is Placer County District Attorney Morgan Geyer discussing what motivated his office to secure the first murder conviction of a fentanyl dealer in California. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Barbie, it is everywhere. Pink is the new color. People are going to the theaters, getting all dressed up, taking pictures inside human-sized Barbie doll boxes. In its first 2 weeks, it's already this year's second biggest earning movie behind Super Mario Brothers and may likely take the first spot in the coming days. The woman behind the camera, of course, is Sacramento native Greta Gerwig. Gerwig has acted in several movies, but you may remember her big solo directorial debut when she wrote and directed Lady Bird, a movie which she called her love letter to Sacramento. Joining us to talk about Greta Gerwig's success is longtime Sacramento entertainment reporter, host, movie critic, and filmmaker extraordinaire Marcus Allen.
Let's go, Barbie!
A big success for Greta. And I think for Sacramento, too. I mean, she's a Sacramento native. You've interviewed her so many times.
Sure.
She grew up in the River Park neighborhood. How long have you known her? How far do you guys go back? And when did you first notice that she was really making a dent in Hollywood?
Well, I've always supported independent film, and she and her friends started a movement, a subsection of independent film called Mumblecore, and super micro-budgeted movies where largely the dialogue is ad-lib and improvised, and it creates this really natural, almost unusual feeling film because it's almost like there's no plot, but it's very realistic. It's like you're voyeuristic. So I started watching some of these movies that she and her friends were putting out, and I knew something would become of it, and she and Noah, when they started their partnership, they kind of spun that type of movie making into a film called Frances Ha. And, you know, everybody talks about she brought it home with Lady Bird. Well, Frances Ha, she's making this movie in New York. And she said, I've got a scene I think we could put in Sacramento. And they shot much of that movie here. So I would say starting back in 2007, I first became aware of her and have followed her, and we've been friendly ever since.
Yeah, and now she is really, like, you know, in the spotlight as a director, as far as a director goes, and you're so tapped into the entertainment industry. When you first heard about Warner Brothers putting a movie out about Barbie, also tapping Greta Gerwig, what was your initial thought?
I said, initially I thought, I hope this sticks, because there were two other incarnations of the movie that, you know, I thought this is going to be interesting. Amy Schumer had a development deal,
right,
I think, with Sony or Universal at the time, and she was co-writing a script for the movie with her sister, and then because of scheduling conflicts or otherwise, she fell off the project. Anne Hathaway was attached for a while. So then when I heard that Margot Robbie had, I said, I hope this takes. And it did. And Margot really championed for Greta to write that movie and got away. She said, I'm not making this movie if Greta Gerwig doesn't write it. She got Greta. And then Greta said, hey, I want my partner Noah to co-write it with me. I'll do it if you'll allow that. So they allowed it. And that trifecta came together to make this movie. And so, you know, within the first 6 weeks of writing the movie, Margot said, you got to direct this thing, too. Greta said, absolutely.
And now we're here as a movie critic. You know, did you like it? What did you think about the film?
I've seen it three times now.
Already?
And
wow.
It is under my skin. And I will tell you this, and it means so much who you watch a movie with and how you watch it. That can affect how you feel about a movie. I had been up doing the morning show that I do since 2 a.m. I have flown to L.A. I've been up for about 10 hours, and I'm watching it with a room full of stoic movie critics. And I could tell I wasn't touching them, wasn't hitting right with them. And I walked away from them thinking it was okay. I said, what a gorgeous movie, beautiful movie, but I wasn't sure if it was going to hit. Then I saw it about a week later with a general audience, including, you know, my family, and loved it, absolutely loved it.
Yeah. I think for me, the trailer was kind of difficult for me to get an understanding of what the movie was going to be about. Obviously, it's about Barbie. But now when reading reviews and also getting feedback from friends and a lot of people who've seen it, I have a better idea of what the movie actually is.
Yeah. When I was talking to Greta, she said, and this isn't to me specifically, but she said, I wanted to make a movie that you didn't know you wanted, but you're going to love it.
Yeah, and it seems like it is. She's accomplishing that because it certainly is a hit. You know, in one of the interviews you did with her about Barbie dolls, actually, and how she grew up with Barbie dolls.
Her weird Barbies. I love that weird Barbie from the movie was inspired by her Barbies.
Well, let's take a listen to what she told you.
I would get a lot of Barbies, like hand-me-downs from the neighborhood, different girls. Bethany Wheeler gave me her dream house. And anyway... But a lot of the Barbies had been already loved into weirdness. And so I had this idea of like, well, we have to have a Barbie that represents that, you know, that represents that fate of so many Barbies. And I wanted her to be funny and wise. And I actually, Kate McKinnon was the first person I thought of. And we've actually known each other since we were 17 or 18. We were in college together. So it was a very full circle moment.
That's awesome. It's my favorite part of the movie, Weird Barbie.
Yeah, Weird Barbie. There's a lot of there's Barbies for everybody, apparently, in that movie.
Oh,
a lot of actors. Given that you have interviewed her so many times over the years, what stands out to you about her most? Is there anything that's ever surprised you that you didn't already know since you've been kind of tapped into her and knowing about her for, you know, well over a decade now?
You know, when I first met her, it was on the set of a Ben Stiller movie called Greenberg. And I said, oh, man, I know her from Sacramento. And she just had this presence. And also what was wild was seeing how many of the cast and crew members kind of leaned into her. She had kind of this nucleus of high-end professionals at all time. And if you really think about it, at that time, like Greenberg, she was a relatively unknown bit player for that movie. But you could tell someday she was going to be running the show. And now she is the highest grossing female director in the history of Hollywood.
I know. And that is incredible. And the two of you actually talked about growing up in Sacramento. And we're going to listen to a moment of you chatting about it.
Good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Sacramento, California. How are you? Good to see you again.
Our whole lives, we've been living alongside each other.
you can leave Sacramento, but it never quite completely leaves you.
Never.
This is awesome to witness right now.
It's really true. No, Sacramento is immovable.
So, how did this all happen? Or you're shooting Lady Bird in Sacramento, California on the wrap. Did you guys go, you know what we should do? Let's get together.
No, I had written Little Women before I shot Lady Bird. So I had written Little Women. I wanted to direct it, but I hadn't directed anything yet. And then I directed Lady Bird. Then it came out. And then they came back and said, do you want to direct Little Women? And I was just incredibly eager to. And I started plotting this as I was releasing Lady Bird. I was like, I've got another shot. I think as a filmmaker, you're always like, oh my God, they're gonna let me do it again. Go, go, go.
Oh, and for context, that the voice you hear in the side saying that's amazing, that's Timothy Chalamet.
Wow.
Who was also in Lady Bird, who played that bad boy from Sacramento.
I'm curious, given that you guys were talking about Little Women, which was in 2019, obviously there is Lady Bird, which is an indie film. I think both can be considered arguably a little more highbrow than Barbie, but Barbie is a hit. What does Barbie add to Gerwig's resume?
I mean, now she is the director of what I guarantee you is going to be a tentpole franchise marquee. There will be a sequel and then about 12 others. You think they spit out Harry Potter's? Wait till you see what they do with Barbie. And by the way, not many people know this, but the Barbie sequences, the most beautiful part of that movie are when you're in Barbie Land. All of that was shot at Leavesden Studios, where they shot all the Harry Potter movies.
Wow.
Talk about juxtaposition.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And given that she is from Sacramento, does Sacramento benefit from Greta Gerwig's success in entertainment?
I'd like to think so. I mean, those of us who travel and associate with people in other cities for any kind of business or whatever reason, sometimes Sacramento is looked down on. And I like, especially in the entertainment industry, they're like, what is Sacramento? You're making movies in Sacramento? So to have someone like her, and if you think about it, a lot of people right now, Greta Gerwig is obviously crushing it. Mm-hmm. She is now responsible for the highest grossing film ever to be directed by a female director. But you've got Joe Carnahan, who wrote and directed several bigger movies. Smoking Aces, the A-Team movie, most recently The Gray, the Black Panther, of course, if you think about that.
Ryan Coogler.
Yeah. Ryan Coogler from Sacramento as well. So, yeah, I mean, all of this helps to put Sacramento on the filmmaking map.
Yeah, and also, we're still on the heels of, there's already a film production going on the movie Sacramento, right? There were some rounds on social media of some of the actors going into some local bars recently.
Can I lay down my predictions on that?
Yes.
So, you know, people say Lady Bird was a lovely calling card to Sacramento. And while it is one of my favorite movies of all time, if you think about it, it's a snapshot of Sacramento and of Sacramento 2003 from an adolescent who doesn't want to be living in Sacramento. It's almost like I got to get out of Sacramento movie. I think Sacramento, the movie, is going to be even more so. I think it's about some people dreading this road trip that they have to take to Sacramento.
Yeah.
If you got to drive 6 hours and end up in Sacramento, that's kind of the mantra of the movie Sacramento that's coming out.
If only they knew, it's one of the fastest growing regions in the state right now.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I want to keep a certain percentage away so that we can enjoy it with a little more room to spread out.
Absolutely. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio, and we're talking about Barbie, Greta Gerwig, and summer movies with Sacramento film critic, filmmaker, and TV host Marcus Allen. It's probably been a few years before we've had like summer blockbuster movies like we're currently kind of swimming in right now, from Mission Impossible, Indiana Jones, Oppenheimer. You know, if people are just going to be going to the movies, you know, really diving into it for the first time in maybe a couple summers, what do you recommend they watch?
That double feature, Barbie and Oppenheimer. You can't go wrong with that.
What an odd one. It's so funny. Barbenheimer was the name or the hashtag.
Exactly. But my suggestion, flip it. See Oppenheimer, then Barbie. Go out on a high note.
Go out on a high note. You also directed a movie. It's called Amy's Effort List. I've actually watched it.
Oh, really?
I loved
it. Thank you.
So what is the premise of the movie?
So it's the sixth movie that I've made with my producing partner, Howard, and he and I often will springboard our movies off of movies that affected our childhood. And when we were relatively young, there was this Michael Douglas movie, got nominated for an Academy Award, called Falling Down. And that movie, you meet this middle-aged guy in his car. It's a hot, sweltery day in L.A. He's stuck in traffic. And you see him snap in the opening credits of the film, puts his car in park and starts walking home and opening up tiny little vigilante moves into growing to a big crescendo vigilante move. And we thought, you know, while that had its day, it would be much more interesting if a young millennial woman was going through that experience. But let's explain why she's going through it. And while we're at it, let's throw a soussance of Thelma and Louise in there. Let's have her sister kind of guide her in this journey and keep her on track. And so that's where we started. That is Amy's Effort List. And it's a movie I suggest you have to watch it to the very end. If you stop and you think you've seen the movie or know what it's going to be halfway through, Not at all. You have to watch it to the very end to realize the movie you've just watched.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. You know, Mark, we're talking about, you know, these great movies and blockbuster movies, but this is happening during a labor strike with Hollywood writers and SAG-AFTRA. It's almost reached 100 days. I mean, what is the core issue here, and what does this really mean for the entertainment, the movies and the shows that we enjoy?
I think at the heart of it, everyone's hurting, and they're hurting still from the fallout of the pandemic because viewership habits changed. You know, so many people went to streaming during that time, and you know, we're still echoing the financial burdens of all of the debt and all the money that was lost during that time. I think things will come back once the health of Hollywood comes back, and you know, with Mission Impossible doing so well, and with Oppenheimer doing so well, and of course Barbie doing so well, people are going back to movies. It's that part of the industry is going to come back. The streaming service and the economics of it, I think with this labor strike, I think they're going to work out how that money needs to get fairly distributed. And I'm optimistic that they will come back. But they have to have money to divide up before they start talking about how to divide the money.
Do you think it's becoming more difficult to be part of the industry in Hollywood? I mean, not the million-dollar checks of actors and directors, but, you know, the people who make a reasonable living being part of Hollywood.
It's tough. It's never been easier to create a competent movie, and it's never been easier to get that movie distributed to a worldwide audience. But it's also never been more difficult to make the kind of profits that Hollywood used to see. So, again, they're going to find out how to manage this. That's what's going on behind closed doors right now. And I pray, I hope, and I do think they will work it out.
Do you think that some projects are going to be delayed, you know, come next summer blockbuster season?
Oh, absolutely. There will be next blockbuster season. There probably will be a bit of a drought. You won't see quite as many movies released. The thing about it, when you have a budget that goes into the $100, $200, $300 million mark, things can move a little bit quicker. So once this strike is over, hopefully they'll be able to catch up on at least the big tentpole movies that we're going to be looking forward to, the movies that say summer box office.
Mark, as always, it's a lot of fun talking with you.
Hey, thanks for letting me hang out. Let's go, Barbie!
Let's go, Barbie!
Paint this room pink!
I'll go watch it this weekend. That is Sacramento entertainment reporter, host, movie critic, and filmmaker himself, Mark S. Allen. Of course, you can watch Marcus Allen on ABC 10, our local ABC station. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Luna's Cafe has long cemented itself as an artistic center of Sacramento, where live performances and art have graced the walls and the stage since 1983, with many returning artists over the decades. Well, after 40 years, Luna's Cafe made the bittersweet decision to close its doors. Cap Radio's Paul Conley reflected with owner Art Luna about the mark he wanted to leave on the city, and they took a look back to celebrate the end of a beloved chapter in Sacramento arts.
It seems Art Luna has always been immersed in the arts. He's a musician and a photographer, and all of the pieces now hanging on the walls here at Luna's are works he purchased from the artists.
These are Sherry Hacker here and Sunshine Gallegos. Tom Witt did this piece back here. It's black on black.
Supporting visual artists was part of the business model from the beginning when Art and his sister Chris opened Luna's in 1983.
Initially, they were Chicano Native American artists because the other local galleries were not showing their work. They considered it folk art. I was working with La Raza Galleria Posada also, and they actually lent us artwork. And that was our first show on the wall.
Aside from the rotating wall art, Luna's hasn't changed a lot over the past four decades. The original oak bar is still here. The dozen or so small cafe tables haven't been updated. Neither has the wood lattice partition that separates the front door from the rest of the room.
You know, we're kind of patterned after a Mexican beach cafe, and we've sort of kept that image. We're comfortable. When people come in here first time, the expression on their face is like, wow, this is neat. God, it feels like home. It's so comfortable.
Lately, the feelings are more bittersweet and nostalgic.
People are coming in and they're speaking about what the cafe has meant to them. You know, that's starting to get emotional. People are coming out of the woodwork and telling me, hey, it's been great. You gave me my first show. I'm like, wow, we've had more of an impact than I think I actually realized through the years.
That's because in addition to supporting visual artists, Luna has presented thousands of performances by local musicians, poets, and comedians over the years. He saw the possibilities in the early 80s and moved back to Sacramento from the Bay Area to start up Luna's.
There was such a hotbed of artists here that was not recognized. It was sort of this below the official level, but you know, just a lot of people playing their own music. Visual arts were really strong here. And even though the Bay Area has more of a reputation, Sacramento was a hotbed back then, and it's grown so much over the years. So it was, you know, easy to tap into that. And it started out slowly, but then I started working with local people like Kevin Seconds, and so I sort of got this connection with a lot of the younger artists at that point that were doing their original music, and then people would call me, and maybe there would be a touring group coming through. So that's kind of how it started, and it's just like a snowball. It just took off from there.
Kevin Seconds and his wife Allison have performed at Luna's countless times since the mid-1990s. They even opened their own Midtown coffee house, True Love, partly inspired by Luna's. Here they are performing at Luna's a few years ago.
Good evening. Hello. Back at Luna's. My husband's having.
There's so many artists in this town that love that place and love art, and seeing a lot of younger up-and-coming musicians, for instance, some of them got their first chance to play on a stage at Luna's. A lot of places wouldn't have even bothered. You know, they would have said, nah, you know, build up a following and then come in and talk to me.
I went there because I was a young, angsty poet, and Luna's has had the longest running poetry reading in Sacramento.
Poet and musician Ruby Jimenez was just 16 when she stepped through the door at Luna's for the first time.
I think I may have read a poem. I can't remember. It was so long ago, but I did approach Art about working there. I definitely solidly worked there for a decade, and I also performed there. One of my friends, Sarah Beth Nelson, she's a very accomplished musician now. But, you know, we played there for, like, both of our first times ever playing anywhere in public. It just points to his willingness to take a chance on people and to just have fun and let people express themselves and not be so consumed with the numbers and the money and the, you know, he just was like, yeah, you think you can bring people in here? Let's give it a try.
I don't put any restrictions on what they do. I just say, give me your best shot. I think just by giving people the chance to play and hone their art here, that's an important function I think that Luna's has had over the years.
Much of that honing and refining is affected by the physical space itself. Luna's is a small room with a stage surrounded on three sides by the audience. Everyone sees who's coming in the front door, just as everyone hears the sounds of the espresso machine in the back. Luna's provided an intimate experience for performers and patrons alike.
If there's 20 people in the room, it feels like a full house. With 50 to 70, it's a really intense kind of standing space, wall-to-wall situation.
I love it. When it's packed in there, the windows are dripping with condensation or whatever, everybody seems to be on the same wavelength, and I just love it. And there'd be this beautiful, quiet moment when somebody's just really just delivering this beautiful ballad. And then you'd hear the, you know, the foam machine. Everybody got used to it. It was just part of it. You know, I think it made me really go out of my way to make more eye contact and connect and see how people are sort of receiving whatever it is I'm trying to put out there.
I can't tell you how many times somebody has come off stage and remarking that people actually listened to me intently. And if somebody's talking too much, I've actually on very rare occasion come out and told people, hey, tone it down.
Over the years, Art Luna has cultivated a gathering place for listening to artists and to each other.
2 days after 9/11, we had a reading here, and the host, she wanted to cancel because it was just so traumatic, and you know, everything was shut down across the nation. And I said, no, people want to talk about this. People want to, you know, get their feelings out and come together as a community. And it was just such an incredible night of poetry, of passion. There was a guy from Beale Air Force Base who stood up and interrupted one poet because he didn't like what he was saying. I came out and said, hey, hang on, you know, this is a free speech zone. If you have something to say, sign up and get up there and tell us, express yourself, which he did. It was really cathartic for, I think, a lot of people that night.
I like the fact that he was very politically in tune. You know, there's backbone there, there's soul there. And that's something that I don't see a lot, especially in business when you start bringing commerce or whatever. You know, people just are kind of going for the quick buck. But he took a stand politically, and you can feel that in there. There's a sense of that.
Latino Democratic Club met here for years, not just community people, but people in the legislature also that were Chicano, Latino. And that was, for me, very important that we were doing sort of this political activism. My perspective about life has always been that we are all in this together. So let's work that way.
One thing that I think is really incredible about Art Luna is that he has really fostered a very safe listening environment for the LGBTQ plus community, as well as people of color and, you know, Latinx. It's always been revolving art shows of voices that are just not heard. It was just such a safe place to express myself and to, I mean, not only come of age, but to be surrounded by a community of other artists.
It's a community hub, you know. It was a place where if you go there, you're going to always run into other creative people. Sometimes I'd be in a slump, you know, and like, I'm not feeling like writing songs. I'm just not feeling it right now or making art. And sometimes just going down there and connecting to that little scene, I walk away feeling really inspired.
And countless others have walked away from Luna's feeling nourished thanks to its healthy menu and juice bar offerings.
The signature dish was always the quesadilla. And it sounds kind of maybe like boring, just a quesadilla, but it just was a very vibrant quesadilla. It just had avocado and jack cheese and olives, black olives, and shredded romaine originally, although I think he switched to spring mix lately. And it was a screaming deal. I think like when I first started, it might've been like $3.25. So it was like everyone, and then you get chips and salsa endlessly. So it was just kind of like one of those treasures.
It's all just basic, good, solid food. The juice bar, it's a natural way to get nutrition. You know, nutrition is so important to me. Without good nutrition, you're not going to have your health for very long. You don't have a clear mind. The menu or someplace that says, Luna's, we feed your body and soul. That's what I'm looking for. And I think we've done that.
What's life after Luna's for art? What are you going to do?
Well, I'm going to probably take a nap for a couple of days. I do want to take a trip to New Mexico, to the Four Corners area, and there's sort of a geologist and a cultural archaeologist inside of me. I love the history of the area. Get back to my photography for sure. I will work with the new owner, helping maintain the performances that have been going on here, which makes sense. You're going to buy a business, you want to kind of maintain the clientele. He did say he wanted to put a small table in the corner there with a couple of chairs, and that was just going to be my reserve table.
For Insight, I'm Paul Conley.
Thank you, Art Luna. Well, I'm going to write a song now. The hour's getting late. I'm going to write a song. song dog that can make people wait. If it makes you happy, we'll sit for a few minutes longer. And if it warms up your heart or it helps make you feel even stronger, let's sing longer. Ride a song dog, I got 400 girls.
And that is Art Luna, the owner of Luna's Cafe in Sacramento, speaking with Cap Radio's Paul Conley about the closing of Luna's Cafe after 40 years uplifting live performances and arts in the city. Luna's Cafe will be open with events through the weekend, so you can go in person to say goodbye. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Nick Dobis and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.